Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 49 of the Filthy Lip Out Golf Podcast with me, Kent Alexander, and John E. Morgan. And joining us today, a man who's not long off of his second European Tour victory, approaching his highest world ranking ever, a real stalwart of birdies for rhinos as well. It's Dean Burmeister. Dean, thank you so much for joining us. You must be just riding the crest of a wave at the moment.
Yeah, something like that. Obviously, first of all, thanks for having me, boys. I've been wondering when I was going to get a call, and I knew I had to probably win a tournament to get this call, so I'm chuffed to be ecstatic. But it's just been one of those purple patches, doesn't it? I mean, that's the great thing about the game of golf, is you never know when it's coming, and when it comes, you just got to keep riding the wave. Your words.
Yeah, riding the wave.
Did you know it was coming? Did you know you were playing well, or did it just come out of the blue a little bit?
Yeah, I've kind of had that sense for sort of over a year. Last year, I had a pretty solid season, but didn't do anything spectacular. I don't know. I think I had 6 or 7 top tens, but nothing was really, really good until the end of last year when I played Sun City. I played really nicely, found a way to manage my game because I actually wasn't playing that great, but mentally got into a good headspace. And that's what was missing pretty much. That and a little bit of putting. And then beginning of this year, probably because of that, put a bit too much pressure on myself and it didn't go my way. And then, you know, did a lot of, listening to podcasts and taking a lot of advice and reading some books and speaking to my team. And then, you know, week in, week out, it just felt better, felt more comfortable. And then boom, just happened. It was awesome.
I know I was going to ask you, Dean, because obviously you get a lot of feedback from the punter, like someone like me who's on course as well. And we're chatting to you, we're doing a lot of questions and stuff like that, like in the, you know, opener to the show or whatever like that. And the question always comes out, is Dean going to get over the line on this one? And what lacks in Dean's kind of armory? And, you know, sometimes, you know, do you take kind of what you've heard to heart, or do you, you've learned from it quite a lot as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Tony Johnson, actually, him and I had a little discussion at Sun City at the SA Open. And, you know, he said something on air that was very true, but obviously I wasn't very happy with, because, you know, it was true. It's probably, that's probably the big thing. And, you know, that's his job, is to tell it as it is. You know, that's all your guys' jobs. And what he said was great. And then we managed to sit down for nearly an hour at breakfast and just chat about it. And that advice that he managed to give me, you know, just don't be so hard on yourself. You know, don't be happy-go-lucky by any means, because that's not who you are. But don't be hard on yourself. Get angry, get upset. But, you know, throw your club in the water, do whatever the hell, but move on, kind of, and find a way to figure that out. And that helped me a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you go back to the weeks that I've played well, you know, I managed to do that, you know, miss a short putt or anything. It didn't really bother me. It was more like, oh, well, okay, that's golf. That's going to happen. That's just the game. It's a brutal game. And the more you can understand that it's bloody difficult, the better I think you're going to play.
Well, when you got a game like you, though, when you got a game like you, mate, which is unbelievable. I mean, you got a power game, which is is always a blessing when it comes to the kind of new courses that we're playing. They're all adding length to it, and you're able to get the power out there to be able to do it. I mean, what big an asset do you think it is? I mean, we just watched like Richard Bland, you know, win a tournament, and Phil Mickelson win, you know, the USPGA, you know, on a monster track, 7,800 odd yards long. I mean,
PGA was a joke.
It was a joke. What was your feelings about that, mate? And, you know, people saying about, you know, making the golf courses longer and stuff like that and hitting the ball further. What do you think of all this?
I mean, look, I'm obviously blessed on the right side of this fence, I think. You know, I've always hit it far. I think due to other sports I did as a kid and stuff like that, just growing up in an environment of wanting to hit it further and wanting to bowl faster when I played cricket and stuff like that. So that just made me develop into, I suppose, having some speed, and then I've been able to harness it and get better. But going on that chat, I think, you know, when I play in America, which is obviously the biggest tour in the world, the PGA, and play the PGA Championship, you get on a tee, when you crush one, the crowd goes mental. You know, that's what they want to see. They're there to see Bryson hit it 400 yards. They're there to see me smack it in the fairway. Yes, they're there to see guys hold putts and do all of that, but the reactions you get from when you smash one down the middle of the fairway and you're walking down the fairway and the guys behind you are 80 yards behind you and they're, oh, who's that guy? What the? You know, they're going crazy. And you just, that
mashed
for me.
Mashed potatoes!
Yeah, exactly. Mashed potatoes, you know. yeah, when I play practice rounds there, playing with Louis and Charles and Garrick also hits it quite a long way. You know, guys are asking you, oh, hit a provisional, and you've just striped it down the middle of the fairway. Like, hit a provisional, hit another one. Yeah, just they want to see you hit another one. And that's a cool feeling. So I think hitting it far is great. But on the other side of that coin, I don't think you have to do that. You know, British Masters, Landy winning, showed that courses don't have to be 8,000 yards to play tough. You know, Kia was another thing. It was windy and tricky. But if there was no wind, someone was going to shoot 20 under par. Yeah. Even though it's a monster track.
Is that where it's really difficult for say yourself, Dean, where your armory is the big dog and you can hit it a long way, but then you come to a really strategic golf course like the Belfry. How hard is it to reel it in and just go, I can't hit that. I'm going to have to hit a little soft 3-wood or a 2-iron.
Yeah. I mean, look, luckily my 2-iron's a big weapon and I really enjoy hitting it quite a lot. So when I get to a golf course like the Belfry, I think I hit two, maybe three drivers every day. I wasn't hitting many drivers. And the 2-iron comes into play, especially when it started raining on the last day and stuff. Just put the driver in the bag and know that fairway is key. And my 2-iron's going as far as other guys' drivers. So I'm standing there licking my chops.
When we swim at Sun City, because they flipped the course around, I was with you.
Yeah.
And you stepped on the 11th, normally the second. Yeah. I think it is. Am I got the right hole? Yeah. Around the corner, and you've gone 2-iron, 2-iron to everyone's driver 2-iron. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you've just absolutely murdered it on there. What is this weapon? What is it? It's Srixon, isn't it?
It's a Srixon, yeah. The new Srixon utility, 2-iron. Nice. And it's got a white tensile in it, which is an absolute, it's basically a broomstick. So I can hit it as hard as I want, really. it's a cool weapon to have. And I'm looking forward to getting to some links golf now that I've got that thing in the bag for sure.
Yeah, definitely, man. Awesome. Yeah.
I want to take you back to Tenerife and that incredible win you had there. I mean, I'm just looking at
it was awesome.
Figures in front of me, 63, 68, 66, 62 for 25. I mean, if there's ever been any doubts, as John alluded to, that's the way to get it done. How did it feel to put a bit of a win drought behind you? Because it had been sort of 4 years since the Schwane Open, your first European Tour. You'd won plenty of times on the Sunshine Tour before that as well. So certainly no doubts about your credentials to get it done, get it over the line there. What were your emotions through that whole week? Because it seemed like you had the ball on a string. You were just doing what you wanted with it.
Yeah, it was, the week before in Gran Canaria when Garrick won, I was actually playing beautifully. And then I had a chance to maybe not win, but possibly at least put some pressure on him on Sunday. And I got out there, had loads of pressure on myself and played absolute rubbish. I mean, I shot one over, played terrible. And again, you know, I'm like, falling back into the same thing. So I promised myself when I went to Tenerife, my caddy and I had a deep chat walking up 18's fairway. I won't go into too many words, but but I mean, there wasn't a lot of clean language used walking down that fairway. And then that actually helped us get ready for Tenerife because now, okay, I shot 63 the first day, played really nice, played okay the second day, and then played nicely on Saturday to get myself into the final 3-ball. And I promised myself on that Sunday, I said, no matter what happens, I'm going to try and be the ultimate professional. That's my goal. I want to be the ultimate professional out there. And just if the putts go in, great. If it's my time to win, awesome. If it's not, I've given myself the best chance to do that. And it just shows you that how important that is, you know, your attitude and the pressure you put on yourself, how important it is to do that. And obviously, look, I got off to a great start, you know, birdied the first two, kind of already caught the leaders a little bit. And then, birdied, missed a short one on 4 and then had that run through 5, 6, 7. And then all of a sudden I'm leading the tournament by 1 or 2 and Calais, unfortunately, didn't get a couple up and down and there it goes, you know, it swings in my favor. And from 11 inwards, I was just like, all right, what's my goal here? I'm going to hit this shot, I'm going to put the ball there, I'm going to get it on the green, give myself a putt because I was putting beautifully. So every hole was just where I'm going to place the golf ball. And then, you know, after 15, when I made birdie on 15, I was leading by 5 or 3 to go. I kind of knew, and even the guys that were playing with me sort of knew just he's just going to canter in from here. And it was great. It was great to be able to have 3 holes because my caddy, Jason, had never won on the European Tour. You know, he'd won on the Sunshine Tour and Asia. And he was 6, you know, he's been on the European Tour 16 years and never had a victory. So to be able to enjoy it for 3 holes with him was really cool. You know, the chats we were having on the greens and stuff were just like, were quite, he was like, I can't believe it. I can't believe where we are. He was almost in awe of the whole thing. And then, you know, to get it over the line and birdie the last and finish at 25 under was awesome. And you know, to have all the Saffa boys down there and spray you with champagne, that's kind of what you practice and work for. So it was a really cool moment.
Yeah,
mate. Dreamy.
You mentioned
exactly right,
guys, and obviously you mentioned playing practice rounds over in the PGA recently with them. A real sort of, I don't know if resurgence is the right word for South African golf, because it's not like it's ever gone away, but just a new generation of South Africans coming through. I think, was it 11 South Africans at the PGA Championship?
Yeah,
the record.
Yeah, 11 of us. That was amazing. Yeah.
Loads of guys, about the same number in the top 100 in the world rankings. You've got Garrick and Wilco coming through. You're back in the winner's circle.
Yeah.
You know, Louis and Charles doing their thing on the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
Tell us about the feeling around South African golf at the moment and being a part of that.
Well, I mean, after we won our fourth one in a row, or fifth, I think we won five out of six. Someone actually sent on the WhatsApp chat. He says, we're going to have to call this the Northern Sunshine Tour. We're taking over. I thought that was quite a cool thing to say, even though it's not really true, but it's it just shows that the guys, I think we got pushed into a little bit of a corner with COVID and everything coming from South Africa. You know, our travel is really tough. And I think the guys have banded together because that's what we have. We have each other and we support each other. And to see a lot of the guys winning is awesome. You know, we've got Daniel Fantonda, who won in Kenya. He's coming through. Yeah. He's been playing well for a long, long time. He just needed his break and he took it. And, you know, Harding winning again. And obviously Garrick, myself, Grace winning in America. Louis obviously always playing well. And Charles starting to play some, put some really, really nice stuff together. So, you know, worldwide, I mean, even Ernie on the seniors tour, just to, you get messages from guys pretty much every week. Well done, great playing. And if you're not, you know, you're trying to help guys that might not be playing well, that make a cut, say, okay, good luck, low the weekend. We're all messaging each other constantly. So that's a great little family and a network to have. And it's needed in these times. I mean.
We need another one up there, mate. We need your mate, Justin Walters, to win one now, don't we? That'd be the icing on the cake.
Totally agree. I'm gonna get him going. I think when I get back out there, we'll get him in the right headspace, and he can just get out of his own way because he's plenty good enough to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you do that with the British for Rhinos with him, mate. Just so I was going to reflect on that because I've seen you out in the bush at Leopard Creek many a time, going around looking at it. And looking at your winner Richard Bland, obviously birdies for Rhino man as well with yourself. I mean, who's winning that birdie fest at the moment for birdies for Rhinos?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not Blandy, but I can tell you. he won with, I think it's the least amount of birdies on tour ever to win a tournament.
Two or three bogeys was it the week?
Yeah, two bogeys for the week, right? I mean, unbelievable! What a performance. World class. But we've given him the nickname Pars for Rhinos because he just makes pars. He says, you're not donating any money, you're going to donate for your pars. Because he doesn't make bogeys either. He's just solid, isn't he? I mean, I think Garrick Higo's leading it. No surprises there. He's he shot, I mean, what did he shoot? Like 80 under or something in 3 weeks? It's ridiculous. I think he's probably leading it.
There must be some serious money accumulating in that pot, because obviously Blandy doesn't make loads of birdies, but he has one and he's making some. You've made an absolute hat load. Garrick making birdies for fun. Yeah. Plenty of other guys on the list. That must be totting up quite nicely what you can do for the Rhinos this
year. The players do an awesome job. And every year the money we donate goes to a great cause, obviously, you know, helping protect them and the systems we use with Cisco and Connected Conservation to not have a reactive, you know, cut the horn off, or still got the rhino in all its beauty. It's proactive. Anyone walks on the grounds, they know about it and they do something about it. So it's a really good way to do it. And it's something that both Justin and I believed in, and that's why we went that way. And it's nice to have all the guys doing that. But on top of that, you know, the top three of that birdies for Rhinos get a weekend away with their family at Londolozi in the Sabi Sabi. So, I mean, that it's an amazing prize that you get on top of donating your money. So the guys are all punting for that as well. And I know Blandy this year says, no, I've got to go. I've been so close. And so I know he's he's got his hair back and he's ready to get there at the end of the year. So, you know, I suppose it's tough to say, obviously, year to year what you donate, but we're close on, you know, that between 60 and 80,000 pounds a year, which is pretty cool between the guys. And in South Africa, obviously, as you know, with the exchange rate and everything, that goes a long way. So it's awesome.
Can I get involved with the British Rhinos and tally it up on my midweek medals around my local track? Is there any chance of that?
Yeah, of course you can do that. We're happy to get it. Get on that leaderboard. We got to have Johnny Morgan on there. Pumping drives, making birdies. Eh?
Yeah, mate, I'd love that. I was a birdie and eagle man.
I would offer my services, but I don't know how much my 0.7 birdie per round average would help. I'll chuck a bit in there. I'll do what I can.
Maybe I'm sure there's a wooden spoon.
We can do net birdies there, Kitto. We can do net birdies. We can always put that up there.
Yeah, net birdies. There we go. All right, I'll get involved with the net birdies and still be at the bottom of the leaderboard.
Well, I don't know. Blandy got beaten by some of the girls who played half the tournaments that he played the other year. So, he's getting some gears for that.
Oh, man, you're going to get some stick now. Now you've said that. That's classic. That's good.
No,
I think it was the number of the tournaments, not the gender, that was the issue there. Just to clarify.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, the girls are good. They're great players and everything. It's nothing against them. They just play less tournaments. So, yeah. You know, when Blandy's played 24 in a year and the girls have only played 14 and they still got more birdies than him, then you know there might be an issue.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so.
You got over to the PGA Championship at Kiawah. Well, we mentioned it a little bit there through your good play. Made the cut as well.
Yeah.
Tell us about that experience over in the States.
Yeah, it was a US Open kind of feel, just because of the golf course and the wind and obviously the length of it, you know. The US Open love putting you to the ultimate test, sometimes ridiculous, but I thought it was set up really fair. I think you can see that in the scoring, you know, under pars, still winning. Guys who play great are doing well and a really bunched leaderboard. So I think it was set up really well. An absolute beast with the visual, you know, Pete Dye is really good at giving you visual monsters, you know, stand on a tee. I mean, we walked off after the second round, knowing I'd made the cut, and my caddy walked with on the way to the golf cart back to the clubhouse, and he said to me, I don't know how the hell you hit some of those t-shirts. I was standing there just closing my eyes, giving you a target to aim at and just close my eyes and hope it goes there and you stripe it straight down the middle. He says, if that was me, I think I'd still be there. So it was that kind of thing. It was really visually intimidating, but wide enough and fair enough that you could go out and make a few birdies. So the Rhinos weren't dodging bullets that week.
No, yeah. Well, mate, what was I going to say? I just heard about off the tee, like it would just look like you're not aiming at anything. You know, you're looking at a bit of a dune and that's it. And it's like pick your point on the dune and commit.
Yeah, and you're hitting over a hazard all the way down the left, and the wind is in out the left. So you've got to start it over the hazard and leak it out to the right, and if you leak it out too far right, you know, lost ball. So it was just visually, you had to have all the shots if you were going to win. And I think Phil showed that with a driver. It was quite nice to see with a driver that he was fading a lot and drawing a lot into the wind just to kind of hold it. And it was a hell of a display. I mean, Louis Oosthuizen does that amazingly well. And that's probably why you see him, you know, finishing second. It just suits him to a tee. He's a great driver of the ball. And once you got in the fairway, there was always a chance that you were going to be able to make a birdie. It was just to get it in the fairway.
When you first seen that golf course for the first time, what do you think the win in total might be? Do you think it might have been anything like Phil's? Or
I didn't think so, no. But the first day I got there on Monday, it was blowing about 35, 40 mile an hour. And, and I went out there for 9 holes and wore out my 4 and 2 iron into par 4s. And I thought, well, this is going to... I mean, if they don't move any tees up, this is going to be carnage. And to their credit, they did move quite a few of the tees up on the into the wind holes to give guys, you know, because some of the PGA pros, some of the carries are 260, you know, into the wind. They got to aim at like a little piece of rough that's 10 yards wide at 235 or 240. So, I mean, they did a good job at setting it up. Otherwise, guys would never finish the hole. I mean, I honestly thought it was going to be, if you shot 4 rounds a level par, I thought you were winning comfortably after the first day. So how many guys are under par? 10 or 11 guys, I think, were under par in the end. I mean, that's awesome. It's great scoring.
And the greens, Paspalham greens, is that a first time for you on Paspalham?
No, I played a few times. You know, Mauritius, the tournament we have in Mauritius is Pas Am at the one course. And then when we're in Tenerife, actually, the Canary Island courses were all Pas Am. So
really?
Or a mix of Pas Am. So it was a mix. To your credit, Johnny, it was a mix. So, I mean, those are pretty good. And then I went and played the PGA Tour event of Puerto Rico once, and those were pure Pas Am. So played a couple times, and a few courses here in South Africa have it in the hotter climates. But yeah, I mean, that was the first time I would have got to Pas Am that were rolling over.
I'm waving at your good lady and your kid in the background, looking through the door, and just waving at her.
At my wife, I'm not sure who's in the background.
Hey, hello.
They came and dropped something off my birthday, a card and a chocolate. Thank you.
Your birthday, wasn't that yesterday, Dino?
Hey.
Was that yesterday? Day before yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday. Yeah, 32 yesterday. Can you believe it? Oh, I look 42, God. But I'm still 32.
I feel like you've been around for so long. I have to say, when I checked on your age, I thought you were older than me. I'm 34 because I thought you've been around for ages. But yeah,
Started young, man. Started 20. I started when I was 20. So, you know, got into Europe when I was, 25. So, yeah, it's been a long road, man. It's been cool. It's been awesome.
Absolutely. You achieved a hell of a lot already as well. How impressive was Phil's display? Because it's one of those ones where obviously it's got a lot of acclaim to it because he's the oldest major winner and everything.
Yeah.
But I almost think as time goes on, it's actually going to become even more impressive. And we haven't quite realised in the moment just what a display that was. For you there on the ground, seeing what the conditions were, seeing what he had to overcome, the field he had to overcome. Just how impressed were you to see Phil Mickelson at his age?
No, unbelievable. It was quite cool. I was around for when he was turning. I was around there, and honestly, the people were going absolutely nuts. And knowing how hard that is we've only ever had one guy, you know, Tiger, being able to do that, to like really focus and control that, because he's had it his whole life. But you know what Phil did, you know, being able to control the crowds, the people on that back nine, and then putting in the display of just doing what he had to do, because he knew Brooks was obviously not playing great. Louis putter had gone cold. He, I think deep down with the last like five holes when he turned downwind, he knew what he had to do. He'd done all the hard work, and being able to control his emotion, you know, and get through that, and then still obviously hit some absolute world golf shots into some of those holes is phenomenal. Like you said, I don't think we grasp how good it is at 50 years old to be able to do that and beat guys in their 20s, early 30s at the prime and the peak of their career. You know, I think like you say, it'll be second to none. I don't think we'll see in our lifetime. I can't see us seeing another one of those performances that great and that to that magnitude.
I still can't believe how far he hits it. Dean, still can't believe how far he hits it.
48-inch shaft, man. Size matters, I tell you.
Yeah. Size matters.
You've played a couple of US Opens as well. You've got the flag on the wall behind you from one there as well. You've got a hoodie on from the US Open. How much has this latest experience as well whetted your appetite for getting in these biggest events regularly? Because it looks like that's
big time.
You're on at the minute.
Yeah, big time. This was, the US Opens, Pebble Beach was... I was almost in awe of how amazing Pebble Beach was, you know. Yeah, it's so sick, man. It's such a cool place. And then it almost felt like I couldn't concentrate because it's so pretty and you're so all over and the event and everything. So I didn't really take in the competitive nature that was in Pebble Beach. At Shinnecock, I might have done so more because it was just grueling and it was my first one and I wanted to do really well. And so this one has made me really hungry because now I've done a few and I've realized, well, I've made two of the three cuts, not necessarily being at the top of my game by any means. So that makes me feel like I can compete. Possibly one day if things go my way, I could win one. You never know. So that makes you really hungry and you know, gets you going. So if I get the call up for the US Open in a couple of days, then I'm on the plane and I'm on my way. No matter what it takes, I'll be there. And then British Open as well. I haven't done a British Open. So ecstatic if I could get in there and play some cool links golf around St. George's this year. So I'm just hungry to play as well as I can and get there and compete. I just want to, if I could get into a final group Sunday and give myself a great chance, that would be, I mean, that would be amazing. I think that'll probably make you even hungrier.
Yeah, mate. Well, I played Torrey Pines, mate. That's some golf course. So if you get to play that one for the US Open, that'd be amazing. Yeah. I'm no caddy, but if you need any pointers, I'll give you a few pointers. It's the first time I ever met Tiger around there, but it was, I think he ended up winning it by about four, like he normally did around that joint when I played it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He loved it, doesn't he? I mean, he...
Oh, he does, man. He does indeed. House. That is his
house. What do you need to go your way to get in Torrey Pines? Do you know, is there, have you got to stay a certain ranking or what's...
Well, no. So with the 10 spots that they have in Europe, obviously South Africans, I couldn't get to the last two of those and I was sixth. And if it had stopped, if Porsche didn't go in, I would have got the 10th spot.
Yeah.
So we've asked for a special exemption.
Okay.
Pretty much. And depending on what the tour says and does, I don't think they can take away the 10 spots, but I think they might have one or two extra spots, because on the race to Dubai, you normally get five spots in the current top 20 as well. And that's kind of fallen away. So I think they've asked the USGA on my behalf to consider this due to COVID and travel restrictions. He can't compete in these events, but he'd really like to come and whatever in the world ranking. So hopefully it goes my way. If it doesn't, it doesn't. That's just the nature of this beast that we're going through. I mean, it is what it is. But you know, if that doesn't go my way, then I still got the British Open, and that'll be my next goal. So we'll see.
Talking about schedules, though, Dean, I mean, it's not easy. You know, coming from South Africa, you know where all majority of the tournaments are. I mean, I see you a lot of times out here in Europe. You know, how grueling is it for you, family, you know, being away from home for such long periods of time? Talk us through it and what the procedures are like.
Well, it's brutal. I mean, look, I've been having meetings with Keith Pele and David Probyn, guys at the tour all year, just trying to figure out what the fairest way is, because I mean, at any one time, I could get to the airport and that airline is not going to allow a South African passport holder to fly to the EU or to fly through Qatar or Dubai or, you know, into Amsterdam or whatever flight we have to take. And now, obviously, most of the countries have brought this 10-day thing in. So, you know, for instance, I was saying earlier, for me to go to the BMW, I've got to go to Italy to an Italy golf training camp for 10 days and stay in a bubble. Hopefully I can get my family to come with me. Otherwise, you know, I could only see them again in 6-7 weeks. I mean, just that's the most brutal thing. You know, before I went in Tenerife, I literally had no idea when I was going to be able to go home, because I'd said to my wife, I'm working on playing well and I'm coming home in 5 or 6 weeks. And then I won, obviously I managed to get home after 7 weeks, but now, you know, I get home and I've been home for 6 or 7 days. And off I go again, you know, in a week's time, I've got to go. So there's no real break. And you've got to go into a quarantine facility where you possibly won't be able to practice. And other guys, you know, get the opportunity to go and practice and get themselves sharp and ready for events. So it's a tough thing for everyone to juggle. And it's obviously tough mentally, I think, on a lot of the guys who miss home and have families, and a lot of guys just have chosen, well, not really chosen, they've just not been able to come out because they've got kids in high school and you know, can't go away for 10 days and sit in a facility and then go away for 7 weeks and not see my wife and my kids. It's just impossible. That's not going to benefit him any either. So a lot of guys have taken a risk, you know, not making an out-and-out effort, and other guys have missed out on entry dates when there's been in a country like Austria has let us go there and do our quarantine there. So, you know, guys missed out on that entry date because Austria, you know, no one wants to go to play in Austria at that time of the year when it's freezing cold. So initially you didn't enter, and then you missed out on five tournaments because of that, because you can't get to any of the other ones. So it's tricky, and mine personally has been a tough road, but obviously I've come out on the good side of it. So I'm lucky, but I think it's worth fighting for the other guys that are still struggling and figuring out what the fairest way to go about it is, and then being able to come home and back like you normally would, you know, do 3-week stretches, come home for a couple of weeks and go again. That mentally, I think, is a great way to do it. So if guys are able to do that, then I think you'll see everyone playing a lot better.
Definitely. Is that a kind of conversation you've had with your good lady, you know, with regarding do you fancy like moving closer to Europe? I know home's where the heart is and family are there, but you ever thought about jumping over and getting closer to the European tour that way?
Well, exactly. So that's we've decided now to bring them over for about 6 weeks, if I can. So that's what I was doing before this podcast. I was busy getting everyone's visas sorted out and special exemption letters and all these crazy things you got to get ready just to be able to fly, because you can't even book your flight if you don't have the right visa. So we got to get everything sorted, and it looks like we're going to get it done just in time. So Friday we'll have everything done and fly out on Saturday. That'll be pretty much our journey, and then we'll do the 10 days in Italy on our own, and I'll go off to Germany, and they'll head off to London and to our house in London there, and just furnish it, I suppose. I mean, this is crazy. I had a house in the UK for nearly a year, and I've slept one night in it, and there's not a bed, not a TV, nothing in it. There's literally a blow-up mattress and a couch. I mean, that's pretty much what that, you know. So I've waited for my wife to furnish it, so she's on her way, and I think she's pretty excited to get that going.
Very wise. A lot of sort of decoration and painting and back garden improvement in my household is anything to go by over this lockdown period. Yeah, a blank canvas will be a great thing for her.
Yeah, gonna love it. I think, I think IKEA is definitely on the cards. A whole day out at IKEA for sure.
Do you keep an eye on your world ranking much? Some golfers obviously know it every week. Others just it takes care of itself. Which side of the fence are you on with that?
I think when it kind of varies for me. When I'm outside the top 100, I'm not too phased about it. When I'm inside that top 100, I try and figure out what's going to be best for me, how many tournaments I need to play, my divisor, what I might be losing. So I do ask around, because the closer you can get to the top 50 with the least amount of effort, the better, right? So exactly. That's where it's all at, Johnny. That's where the big money is. And if you can get there by December, that's where Augusta's at. And I think every boy's dream to go and play Augusta. So, so I'm working on it. I'm looking at it now pretty much weekly, trying to figure out where's best for me to play and where's not. So once you get that recipe, you can do that pretty much every year and carry on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're only two scores away now from your career best world ranking, which was 86 in February 2016. So obviously the form you're in at the moment looks like you're going to go past that from your position of 88 at the moment. And as you say, that top 50, that's where the gold lies. Get in there by the end of the year, at the turn of the year, invites for all of the majors, all of the WGCs. And you've shown you're at home in that kind of company, certainly. So I wanted to rewind a bit and go back to, your childhood, really, because I didn't know you were born in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
How old were you when you moved from Zimbabwe to South Africa?
So I was 14, 2003. And unfortunately, due to the situation there and everything, we lost everything, our farm and our home and everything. And we literally had to jump in a car and move ship within a month. And luckily, my dad was actually born in South Africa. Mm-hmm. So that gave us a way in. Otherwise, I don't know where we would have gone. We would have probably had to go to the UK, because at that stage, you know, both my parents are UK passport holders. So at that stage, you know, we would have been able to probably go in as dependents with them to the UK, but you know, South Africa was the best option, and my parents managed to get me into great school here, and I think that just made me go from strength to strength. It was a highly competitive sporting school, and from there until matric, it was all about playing sport and seeing what I can do. And after that, I went to a small golf academy here in the town I was in, Bloemfontein, and finished out 2 years there, turned professional, and started my way on the Sunshine Tour at 20, and haven't looked back since. So it's been pretty cool. I mean, if it wasn't for that move and that kind of thing happening, who knows what would have happened, you know, in my career, in my life. Because when I was in Zim, I was playing cricket. Cricket was everything for me. But as you know now, cricket is absolutely brutal. It's so tough to get into any team. Yeah. It's crazy. So Glad that it happened for me, but it's something my parents probably don't look on too fondly. But it was okay.
Your father played cricket for Zimbabwe, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, my dad took the first ever international test wicket for Zimbabwe. Yeah,
really? That's awesome.
Hey, how good is that? Wicked,
yeah. So good, yeah. Wow. He nicked off Sunil Gavaskar's first slip, which is, he tells me, don't worry. I've heard the story a few times.
I bet. What are your memories of Zimbabwe in those early years? Because it must be strange for you. Now, do you identify as Zimbabwean, or do you still feel a part of you is there in Zimbabwe?
Yeah, definitely a part of me is there. I mean, I've now been in South Africa longer than I've been in Zimbabwe. So I'm probably a South African at heart. I've lived here longer than I have there. But I mean, I'll always be born there. That's my home. And growing up there was world class. It was an amazing place. I was never inside. I mean, we had on the farm, you know, we were lucky enough to have a bunker and a green. You know, my mom played competitive golf. So, you know, our garden boy made sure that we had everything sorted. You know, balls were next to the bunker, packed out for us, ready to go. And I mean, I had probably the best upbringing you could imagine. I mean, it was really sort of old school Victorian down there. And you know, what was said was done kind of thing. Everything was on a handshake, and it was just go and play 36 holes or 72 holes in a day sometimes in the summer and just beat a little ball around the golf course and, you know, play cricket in the holidays. You had a cricket match every day, you know, 7 days a week. Yeah, you're just playing teams against each other, and every holiday you're in a different city or town, and you went and you were 10 years old, got on a bus and off you went. Yeah, parents never saw their kids, I think, in Zim in those days. That's because the parents were doing their own thing, playing their own golf and sport, and the kids were doing their own thing. So you just met up, I think, at 7 o'clock every night for dinner. That was pretty much.
Tell everyone about the various sporting fixtures you've done during the day.
Exactly, exactly right. So it was a great place to grow up. I mean, I wouldn't change it for anything. And then, you know, obviously coming to South Africa, my eyes opened up a lot more, and there was a lot more competition. And I realized I probably wasn't good enough for cricket after one of my best mates hit me for 5 sixes in one over.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, oh, I thought I was okay. You know, I was okay. He ended up playing for the Proteas. So I don't feel too bad. He ended up playing for South Africa, Riley Rousseau. So that was the end of my cricketing career right there, pretty much. I wasn't going to go and embarrass myself any further. And that's when I started taking golf up seriously. So all for the best, I think.
Wise choice, I think.
Good change, man. Good change.
I think so.
How much did it shape your development as a professional sportsman, the fact that your father had played cricket at international level, your mother had played golf to a very high level as well, and the influence and guidance they were able to have on you?
Well, I think as a kid, I think you see this a lot. You see parents really pushing their kids too hard, and especially when the kid shows a lot of promise. You know, whereas my parents had been there and done it, which is quite nice in a way. So they knew kind of where to space, you know, leave their space to themselves and leave me alone to do my thing, and where they needed to push me, and so to have that kind of guidance really helped a lot. It kind of shaped me into where I was when I was 20 years old and ready to turn professional. You know, if I didn't have that, I would have probably been another 2 or 3 years behind. You know, if I look at a lot of my other mates that were in the same academy as me, their parents were really different. You know, when we played a tournament, their parents were at the tournament every time. My parents might be at the tournament, but they would be sitting, waiting, or watching from a distance and not really getting heavily, heavily involved. And then afterwards, having a chat to me, you know, what did you do there? Why did you react that way? You know, you can do things a little better and that kind of thing. So I think parenting is very important when it comes certainly to golf, because there's so much time. And you see little kids that are, you know, worldwide winners already, and they, you know, 9 years old, and they've won tournaments in America and Asia and traveling the world, and their parents are just pushing them. And then by 14, 15, they're like, you know what? I'm done. I don't want to play golf anymore. I'm finished.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be doing that when you're in your 20s. You shouldn't be doing that when you're 9, 10 years old, I don't think.
Yeah,
you should be loving it and enjoying it.
When you're a child, any sport you play, but even if you're really good at it, it's got to be because it's fun, because you're a kid.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you get to your late teens and you want to make a career out of it, then great, crack on. But yeah, that fun element has got to be front and center for any child playing sport.
I mean, I remember growing up and there were 12 of us on the putting green having putting competitions and that kind of thing. So different to today. You know, when you get your kid wins a tournament, parents don't stick around, grab the kid, go, you know, that's it. don't leave him with all his other friends and let them actually enjoy what's happening. It's a very different day and age today to what like we grew up. I mean, it's crazy. I was never not on the putting green or chipping green, having a game against my mate for absolute pride because you didn't have, you know, a couple quid or anything. Mommy and daddy had that. So you just played for pride or on the golf course and played for a Pro V1 or something and off you went, you know. That was the way we grew up, you know. And now it unfortunately just doesn't work that way. And it's sad to see. And I think that's why you see a lot of guys really young, really good, and then they kind of filter away, I think. You know, no disrespect to any of them, but Matteo Manassero is a perfect example. I only hope he comes back and better and bigger and stronger. But, you know, there's a guy, I've played with him numerous times. He was world-class. I mean, top 50 player in the world for sure. Unbelievable. He didn't hit a three wood straighter than I could hit a wedge. You know, it was just... And, yeah, now, you know, he's playing on other tours. Tough.
But that's a little bit of distance as well. If you're not as... blessed with the distance naturally, yeah. Matteo, he made the decision, I need to add a few more yards, and it's a slippery slope. It can go one of two ways. Yeah, that can take the game to the next level. It can also destroy, frankly, the good technique and the great golf that you already had. And he is fighting back a little bit on the Alps Tour. He had a white on the Alps Tour last year, a couple of runners up early this year. He's had a few Challenge Tour starts this season as well, so hopefully he'll find his way back.
Hopefully he'll find his way back, exactly, yeah.
It shows the dangers, doesn't it? You change something, and that's what I find fascinating, talking to professional sportsmen, because obviously John's been there, you're there right now. It's that constant pursuit of wanting to be better. So you're always looking for that change, that improvement, that little tweak in the swing that's going to do it, that... like you found, that little mental approach that you do slightly differently that does it.
Yeah.
But there are all these cautionary tales of what happens when it doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
I just find the balance of knowing when to change and what to change versus what not to absolutely fascinating, and how you navigate that as a professional sports person.
I think that's where, when you get to the professional level, having a great team around you is important. A great coach that you admire that has the same system. He doesn't vary... okay, well, this coach is coaching this year and his players are all doing well, so I'm going to do a similar thing or whatever. He believes, he sticks to his guns. Yes, he improves maybe some of the things he could do, but at the end of the day, his theory is working for you and you just keep at it. You just keep doing it. And then, you know, having a great management team and you know, psychologists and everyone around you just telling you, you know, don't, like you say, don't go too far. Sure, there's tweaking for that 1%, but there's, you know, 1% could take you from 150th to 50th in the world. That's how close the game is. You're not looking for 25%.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. You know, I've been lucky enough to speak to Bryson about it, and he says the amount of work he's got to put in now is, you know, 10 times more than he's ever put in to do what he's done. And I mean, it's nuts. If you look at him work, every day at the PGA, he was the last guy to leave that putting green. Every day. You know, every day I was there for a late practice on the putting green when the wind died down, he was still there, hadn't left the golf course. He's eating on the putting green. He's not going inside for lunch. He's fully committed to his process, and that is just full out bomb gouge putt in, pretty much. And that's unbelievable, the work ethic.
I mean, I was going to ask you that question then. So say if you tried to do that, how would your body, do you think, would hold up hitting this and doing that all the time? How do you think it would hold? And do you think his body's going to hold up? And do you think he's needing to slim down a little bit now maybe, or take it a little bit easier?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's tough to say, obviously, because I think he's the first guy to ever really do it. So you don't know how it's going to work. But if you look at how strong he is, he can do it. I think if I were to do it and try and hit it like that, trying to get 200 miles every time, I mean, I'd definitely break my back or something would go wrong. I just don't see that working for me. I'm quite happy caressing it and seeing what happens. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see as to what happens with his body and go from there. I mean, if it holds up, amazing. If it doesn't, I mean, I think he's definitely put himself at risk for a shorter career. I think you can definitely say that. He's put himself at a high risk for a shorter career. And I think even if you look at Brooks now having to have knee surgery and stuff, you know, going into that gym, Rory's had his issues. I think when you train that hard in the gym, you definitely put yourself at risk of shortening your career to an extent.
It's the gamble. Do you risk taking your game to that next level, but something you can probably only sustain for 5 or 8 years potentially?
Yeah.
And think, right, well, then I'm going to absolutely maximize these 5 to 8 years. And after that, you know, my body's going to be shot. I'm not going to be able to do it at this level.
Yeah.
Or do you go for the longevity and think, well, I'll give myself 20 years at the top and have a stab that way. And I might be at, like you say, fine margins. I might be 5% worse than if I really absolutely threw everything at it for these 5 years. But I'm not risking my body. And, you know, we've heard Tiger talk about with all his back things and the surgeries that when he was coming back from the latest one, I just wanted to be able to play with my children and pick up my children and walk and have 9 holes with Charlie in his case. You know, there's almost an element of, is Bryson risking that? Like, we don't know. He's done incredible.
We
can't take anything away from him. But what's his body going to be like when he's 50, 60 years old? Is he going to be able to lift up his children or his grandchildren or play 9 holes with them? We don't know. And it's,
we don't know.
Are him for taking that risk and for doing what he's done. But there's an element of risk to it, not just in your golfing career, but I think that your physical well-being in the long term as well.
Look, I think that's the great thing about the game that we've chosen to play and be a part of, is there's so many ways to do it. There's not one body type that can win and perform at the highest level. You know, everybody's got a chance, but what he's chosen to do, I think that's something he's going to have to live with. Like you say, who knows when he's 50, what his body is going to be like. I think a perfect example of
someone. It's Tony Johnson and Dale Hayes.
Oh, that's funny. But it's a guy who I think has done a great job at managing his career in longevity is Westy.
Yeah,
I mean, Westy was overweight when he was younger. I mean, he was fine when he came out, then he got overweight. Then he realized, well, if I want to play in my 40s, I can't be overweight. I'm going to have to. And now he's not exactly a Rafa Cabrera Bello, but he's strong, man. He's training and he's fit. And look at him. He's 48 and he's, what, top 30 in the world? I mean, it's a joke.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's great.
He's managing at the right level. Like, he had that little period where he got super, super fit and strong.
Yeah.
But I think he kind of realized I need to, there's a happy medium.
Yeah, there's a happy medium. And I think everybody's bodies are different. But look at him now. I mean, he's so strong. I mean, he's really strong. And you go and watch him in the gym. He trains hard. But I think, like you say, there's a happy medium. He knows when his body's had enough and he's going to take a little break. And then he comes back. So we all got to figure out our own path in our own way. And that's part and parcel of what I'm doing. I'm kind of figuring out that training away from tournaments is better for my body, because I don't feel like I get any small little wrist pains or knee pains or anything that might pop up. I have no issues with that. And in turn, I get less physio and I'm able to actually stretch and do my routines myself without any massive help, which has helped in the COVID times, because obviously you can't have your full team traveling with you. So, you know, that's something I've learned, just for instance, with the way mine goes. I'm better off training at home in the gym and then going to the events and doing my golf and some light training and then coming back home and doing my heavy training again when I'm back home. Mm-hmm. I think everybody's different, you know. Other guys, Louis, for instance, I know doesn't step into a gym. He's purely physiotherapy and he might go and ride a bike or go for a run. Everybody's different and they figure out their own way. Like I say, you know, if having 6 Guinness a night is going to make you win majors, then have your 6 Guinness a night. But if it's not, then don't do it. You know what I mean? You just got to figure out the way that's best for you.
I think that's where I'm going wrong. I'm only having 5 Guinness a night.
Oh, yeah,
I've got to have 6. 6. That 7 handicap's going to come tumbling.
That's it. You'll be a 0 before you know. You'll be scratched before you know.
I mean, obviously, the travel's been difficult for the last 18 months, but you must have had some wonderful experiences on the road, going to great countries, being on tour with your mates prior to that. What are your favourite countries you've been to visit? Any great stories, great experiences you've had along the way?
I mean, there's so many. I started my journey with leaving my backpack on a train from Paris to Saint-Omer, and the backpack ended up in Brussels, which that was an adventure to start my career, and not the greatest way to start. But since then, it's kind of been awesome. I've been able to go with my family to amazing places I would never have seen. You know, Lake Garda, you know, into Rome, and go and see the Vatican City and the Colosseum, and do a whole day trip into Rome. You know, that's just in Italy. You go to Paris, go to the Eiffel Tower, you know, spend a day in London doing all the London things, you know, and then I've also been to Thailand, Puerto Rico, you know, now the Canary Islands, you know, small islands I would never have visited, you know. You know, Mauritius is another great destination where you can go. But I mean, recently I had probably one of the best experiences I've ever had is in the Canary Islands. We were able to go out and actually go to a restaurant and walk on the beach a bit and do things like that in the evenings, which was quite nice. So because of that, we're allowed to go out the bubble and retest when we got in the bubble and actually go and do something. And Victor Dubuisson organized a tuna fishing trip for myself, him, Jamie Donaldson, and Justin Walters. And the four of us.
Awesome.
And we caught three fish over 300 kilograms. Each fish was over 300. Yeah. And it was unbelievable.
What? Crazy. So level with me then, Dean. How sore were your muscles reeling them bad boys in?
So that was the Monday before I won.
That's the key. That's what you need to add into your prep.
My trainer phoned me and said, "You see, Jim in the tournament does work." And I was like, different kind of gym. But honestly, Tuesday wasn't quite a write-off, but it was close. I mean, I wasn't able to do a lot of work on Tuesday. So I managed to get 9 holes in. But it was a laugh speaking to the other boys as well. I mean, I know Jamie Donaldson had a fresh air and a couple of pipes in 9 holes, and played with Justin. And we were looking for balls all day pretty much on Tuesday. So it wasn't ideal, but by the time we got to Wednesday, we were all ready and rearing to go. So luckily the bodies held up. But yeah, it was brutal, man. You could only fight the fish for 20 minutes at a time max. If you were gonna bring a fish in on your own for that 90 minutes, 2 hours, I mean, there's no ways you pick up a club for 3 or 4 days. It's impossible.
Victor loves his fishing, doesn't he? He must have been
loves
absolute
it.
Element.
Yeah, loves it. I mean, we try and hook up when we can in Dubai, decent fishing in Dubai. Oman's got great fishing when we go there. And then, you know, when we go up into the mountains, Justin loves his fly fishing. So when we go to, you know, Northern Ireland or north in Scotland, and we go trout fishing a bit. And so it's something we've liked to do over the years, and it kind of takes your mind off, and it's a big passion. I'm about to invest in a little boat so that I can go and do my own fishing back home. So I mean, something we really enjoy doing. And I think a lot of golfers love doing that. It's either fishing or gambling, it seems like. I'm going to fishing route.
One's probably slightly healthier for the bank balance and mentally than the other.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I'm going the fishing route. I don't think I want to be stepping into the gambling.
I mean, you did mention Ovi's, Tony Johnson, give you some good words of wisdom at Sun City. Is there been... Yeah. Many other times down in South Africa or around near Zimbabwe where you've been able to, you know, cut loose, go our way, have a four ball with some of the other top players, give you some little pearls as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been lucky enough to spend a bit of time with Gary Player on his farm when he still had the farm. So that wasn't too far away from where I used to live in Bloemfontein. It was about an hour away. So used to go there, been there a couple of times with the school and taking some of the schoolboys there. I've been fortunate enough to play, and Ernie Els has a 2-day event for charity and stuff down here in South Africa. So I've played that a couple of times, and Ernie's been great. I mean, but most of the time when you get to play with the guys are at events, that's probably where you get the greatest wisdom. I mean, one of the best moments I've had was when I got to Shinnecock Hills. And I'd only met Nick Price when I was really, really young, but he grew up playing with both my parents. And he walked straight onto the range to me and he said, "Dean, I've booked a tee time for you Wednesday afternoon, 3 p.m., just you and me." And we went out for 9 holes, him, and he gave me advice the whole way around Shinnecock Hills on that back, which was, I mean, that was something he didn't need to do. He was he was world class. It was a really special moment, and that's just the kind of guy he is. But you know, Ernie, when I first time I got to Qatar, I managed to play 9 holes with Ernie, and he took me around somewhere. I think he's won there 3 times, so he took me around there and said, "Yeah, yeah, win the flags over here, hit it over there," and helped me and gave me some wisdom when I was starting my journey out in Europe and with travel and stuff. And if I ever needed anything, just to give him a call. So you know, that's always good. And Ovi's has always been great. You know, Tony's been world class, and a few of the other guys, even down here in South Africa. You know, Dale's pretty good at seeing you at events and saying, "How's it going? How's the travel?" and just chatting you through stuff. Something he's done for years and did for years. And John Bland's here at Fan Court, so I spent a bit of time with Blandy, and Blandy's great at saying, "Well, when you go to America, you're more than welcome to stay at my place, and we can figure some stuff out. And if you ever need any help with anything, let me know." And so there's guys all over, and I think that's just part of the community of South African golf. It's really awesome. We're really lucky.
Is Nick Price the striker of an iron, like everyone says he is, mate? Still one of the best strikers.
Yeah, he still hits amazing. My coach was actually here for a couple of days, and he was showing me some swings of him hitting a Hogan Apex 2-iron. I mean, the noise it makes when it comes off there is something else. I don't think there's too many boys worldwide that would be able to do it today. I'll tell you that much.
Did you ever get to play with like Blatter balls, the old school, really soft ones that used to spin crazy?
Yeah. Blatter, tall professionals.
Yeah.
I mean, one bunker shot and you put it in a bag, isn't it? I mean,
it's got a mobile straight away, isn't it?
When you're a kid, I tell you what, those things, you made those last 4 rounds.
You did, mate.
It was dark brown when you threw it away.
So true.
I wanted to ask about Victor Dubuisson again, just because he's such an enigma. And obviously he was brilliant in the Ryder Cup, and you've obviously spent a fair bit of time with him fishing and stuff. And that, you know, you hear from outside that he's actually more interested in fishing than he is playing golf at the moment. Yeah. But all that talent, what is he like as a person?
Honestly, he's awesome. He's a great dude. He's super friendly, but like you say, he is a bit of an enigma. Yeah. But I think golf is what he does, and fishing is his passion. Mm-hmm. So he really comes out of his shell when he's out there fishing, and we're just having a good time. You know, he'll come up with some pearls of wisdom and have some great fun. Mm-hmm. Just you know, normal guy humor. But when you get him at the golf course, he's really reserved and internal, and I think he's just trying to find a way to enjoy his golf and do his job, I think, so that he can go fishing. I think he just wants to make money so he can get on the boat and catch some fish.
Yeah, you don't want to give him a chipping competition. I've heard that for one, that's for sure.
No, he's amazing. Yes, one of the best short games you'll see for sure.
Yeah,
sweet. So you're obviously over in South Africa at home now.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed for that exemption into the US Open. How's the rest of the summer sort of playing out for you from here on?
I'll be going to BMW International in Germany, and then Ireland, Scotland, and hopefully the Open. Mm-hmm. And then I'll head back, hopefully be able to head back home, come home for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and then get out there for, I think it's probably Czech, and then is it Italy? Italy Wentworth, I think, is the next run, and the Daniel mm-hmm. Inks. So I'll do like a 4 or 5 week stretch there as well. So 4 or 5 weeks now, and then a couple of weeks off, and then 4 or 5 weeks again, and then end of the season, pretty much. It goes by so fast, it's crazy.
Sorry, you must be so excited for what's ahead. You're 18th in the race to Dubai.
Yeah.
41st last year was your best ever finish. You'd finished 42nd a couple of times.
Yeah.
Right on the fringes, the cusp of getting into all these majors as well. I mean, how buzzing are you just about your game at the minute, and what lies ahead of you this summer?
Yeah, I'm obviously really excited. You know, I'm going to a lot of courses that have played well in the past. So that's good, knowing that I have that level of comfort of having, you know, that exemption for the next few years. That helps. I haven't had that obviously for four years or so. So it helps mentally, knowing you can go there and express yourself a bit more, take a risk or two you might not have taken, and try and win a tournament instead of maybe playing it a little safer. So yeah, I'm excited for all the elements, really. I think everything's come together nicely, and it's been a long process with my team and my coaches, and now it's just kind of go out there and like I say, express yourself and try win win more events, you know, try and get up that race to Dubai and the world rankings. And hopefully by December, if everything goes to plan, we can go to Augusta.
Absolutely.
Oh, mate. Well, I'm hoping to go to Augusta next year, mate. So I'll hopefully see you there. I'm trying to sort out like a little 12-man plan to go out there, give some coaching and go and watch the Masters at the same time. So
nice.
That might be my first time as well, mate. So hopefully we do it together. That'd be brilliant.
That'll be awesome. If you need a room at the house, let me know, Johnny boy.
Yeah, I'll take you up on that. Legend. Man, I know what I was going to ask you, man. I mean, because it's a big thing for me because I love my animals and I know you do. With Justin Waters, you set up this Birdies for Rhinos. And what's the ultimate goal? Because I know we've had Justin on before. Yeah. For people that have not tuned in to listen to Justin yet on our podcast, can you tell us what the ultimate goal is and what you want to achieve in this Birdies for Rhinos? And kind of give us the scenario of what's going down at the moment in these hard times and what you're trying to change.
So basically, to give you guys just a rundown of how it's going, we're losing a rhino. We're pretty much losing a rhino a day. At the moment, and with the vast majority of rhinos obviously being lost in the Kruger National Park, the ultimate goal would be to, if everything goes to plan, get the technology in there and save as many rhinos as we can. For Birdies for Rhinos, our stuff is more awareness. You know, we don't have the cash behind us to make a massive indent into what needs to be done.
Yeah.
Our partners that we're partnered with do, and that's what's exciting. So we can hopefully grow it into something massive where we can save these animals and other animals, you know, worldwide. You know, we've got other interests in New Zealand and you know, Kenya and stuff, saving a lot of wildlife, because it's not, you know, when they go and they poach a rhino and they do well, they might have shot a lion and a leopard or another couple of animal on the way, you know, and then they're walking out with all these things and the animals are unprotected. You know, they're in this vast area that's hard to protect and, you know, they're pretty much sitting ducks, because a lot of the time, you know, there can be inside jobs and guys are throwing these animals under the bus. And that's pretty much what we want to stop, because it'll be a sad day if our kids or even our kids' kids, you know, can't go to a national park or can't go on a safari anymore and see these majestic creatures, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why we started it, and that's still the end game, is to just get this to stop, figure out a way so that this can just come to an end and we can all live happily on one planet, basically, humans and animals. Pretty easy.
What on the legend, mate.
Amen to that. Amen to that. You're absolutely right. It's great to see the work that you guys are doing. Dean, brilliant to see you making so many birdies, not only for that cause, but also for the trophies and getting you into majors and the fantastic form you've been in as well. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a brilliant chat. I've really enjoyed it. John, thank you to you as ever as well. Man. And thank you to everyone for listening. We really appreciate every listener, every time you share, like, review our podcast as well. So please do that. You can follow us and interact at Filthy Lip Out on Twitter. But that's all we've got time for this time. We'll see you next week.
Kick ass, Dino.